You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
Hey, everybody. Today, I want to highlight a name that all of us know well, and that is our sponsor, Splunk. You need to keep operations humming around the clock, but potential disruptions are everywhere. Splunk helps you predict problems and find and fix issues fast so you can reduce risk and ditch downtime. The world's largest enterprises rely on Splunk's unified security and observability platform to become more efficient, resilient, and innovative. With Splunk, you can react quickly, evolve faster, and be ready for anything. Stay ahead of disruptions. Learn more at splunk.com/resilience. And we thank Splunk for sponsoring our show. In the dynamic world of enterprise security, identity architects and IT leaders face a major challenge. Growth by repeated acquisitions multiplies the complexity of everything. Multiple IDPs, MFA providers, policy engines that all need to coexist. This can lead to fragmented user identities and policies that create security vulnerabilities and add access friction. Strata Identity solves this. Now you can decommission unneeded IDPs and consolidate the ones you'd like to keep without rewriting apps or disrupting users, engineers, and app owners. Plus, Strata's modular architecture makes it easy to integrate with any identity provider without manual maintenance and coding. Join the ranks of cybersecurity leaders using identity orchestration. Visit strata.io/cyberwire, share your top identity security priorities, and receive a pair of complimentary AirPods Pro. Offer valid for organizations with over 5,000 employees. Step into a new era of identity management at strata.io/cyberwire. The Russian malware used against Ukrainian targets. Actual and potential targets hardened themselves against Russian cyber attacks. Sanctions and the criminal underworld. Conti's fortunes. A credential stealer resurfaces in corporate networks. Black Cat ransomware warnings. Tomer Bar from Safe Breach discusses muddy waters. Our guest is Dr. Christopher Emden with a preview of his new book, STEM, STEAM, Make, Dream. And CISA releases three more ICS security advisories. From the CyberWire studios at Data Tribe, I'm Dave Bittner with your CyberWire summary for Friday, April 22nd, 2022. The Record has an overview of the Russian malware that's been used against Ukrainian targets. Wiper malware has been particularly prominent so far in Russia's hybrid war. Citing conversations with Ukrainian security officials, they describe Whispergate, Whisperkill, Hermetic Wiper, Isaac Wiper, Acid Rain, Caddy Wiper, Double Zero, and Indestroyer 2. The Straits Times reports that Ukraine has worked to upgrade its defenses, for the most part through implementation of widely understood cybersecurity best practices. This week's joint cybersecurity advisory by the Five Eyes is prompting similar moves in other countries, Bloomberg reports. The energy sector is receiving particular attention, an essay in the Wall Street Journal explains. China, looking on as an observer generally sympathetic to Russia, more or less a tepid ally of convenience, on the familiar grounds that the enemy of my enemy is, well, sort of, anyway, my friend, sees U.S. preparation in cyberspace as dangerous provocation. The Global Times, a Beijing mouthpiece, argues that U.S. defend-forward policy is destabilizing and contravenes international norms of conduct. The U.S. Department of Treasury has taken punitive steps against Russian organizations found to be enabling other groups' evasion of sanctions imposed in response to Russia's war against Ukraine. Of particular note is the addition of BitRiver AG, a prominent crypto mining venture, to the list of sanctioned entities. For its part, TechCrunch reports, Russia has responded to a tightening sanctions regime by designating various prominent U.S. citizens as henceforth barred from travel to Russia. Their list includes Meta's Mark Zuckerberg, LinkedIn's Ryan Roslansky, and Vice President Kamala Harris. The welcome mat will be yanked from others, the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs explained, as it develops and expands its list of Russophobes. They said, in the near future, a new announcement will follow about the next replenishment of the Russian stop list in the order of countermeasures against the hostile actions of the U.S. authorities. There's no particular evidence any of them were planning to, let alone longing to, travel to Russia, but we'll leave that aside. It's a move against leading Russophobes. Sanctions designed to inhibit the flow of money to the entities they affect have a collateral impact on the parasitic criminal economy that accompanies legitimate markets. Flashpoint describes the ways in which sanctions against Russia have made it more difficult for cyber gangs to cash out. The takedown of the Hydra market, for example, represented a direct interdiction of a traditional cash-out avenue. And not only do the sanctions themselves directly impede the gangs, but the countermeasures Russia is taking to increase central control of its economy are also having an effect. Flashpoint writes that gangland chatter suggests the criminals are looking into peer-to-peer cryptocurrency exchanges, conventional bank transfers that sanctions don't yet reach, and Chinese-run UnionPay cards. The gangs are also considering hunkering down and holding their gains in cold wallets until the heat blows over. SecureWorks looks at Gold Ulrich, a prominent operator of what the researchers characterize as Conti Ransomware's name and shame site, and describes how it has adapted to recent revelations and setbacks. Costa Rican authorities are also blaming Conti for attacks aimed at disrupting that country's presidential transition. Six public institutions have been affected. In short, it seems that the incursions into Conti's private chatter by Ukrainian and Ukrainian-sympathizing operators has had a negligible effect on the ransomware's operations. Some observers thought that the privateers would sustain reputational damage from the leaks, but it turns out that the reputation under threat was not the kind of reputation people care about in the criminal underworld. eSentire reports a fresh infestation of More Eggs malware across various company networks. The credential stealer is being distributed in a spear phishing campaign that targets corporate hiring managers with fish bait representing itself as resumes from fictitious job applicants. More Eggs last surfaced a year ago. The U.S. FBI has issued a flash alert on Black Cat ransomware, describing the indicators of compromise associated with this strain of double extortion malware. The alert also describes the typical course of a Black Cat attack. The FBI says, Black Cat ransomware leverages previously compromised user credentials to gain initial access to the victim's system. Once the malware establishes access, it compromises Active Directory user and administrator accounts. The malware uses Windows Task Scheduler to configure malicious group policy objects to deploy ransomware. Initial deployment of the malware leverages PowerShell scripts in conjunction with Cobalt Strike and disables security features within the victim's network. Black Cat ransomware also leverages Windows administrative tools and Microsoft sysinternals tools during compromise. Leaping Computer reports that Black Cat has affected at least 60 organizations worldwide. And finally, CISA has released three new industrial control system ICS advisories.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust Plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zero-trust-AI. The IT world used to be simpler. You only had to secure and manage environments that you controlled. Then came new technologies and new ways to work. Now, employees, apps, and networks are everywhere. This means poor visibility, security gaps, and added risk. That's why Cloudflare created the first-ever connectivity cloud. Visit cloudflare.com to protect your business everywhere you do business.
My guest today is Dr. Christopher Emden. He's a professor of education at the University of Southern California, where he also serves as director of youth engagement and community partnerships at the USC Race and Equity Center. He's the founder of HipHopEd.com, and Dr. Emden is author of the new book called STEM, STEAM, Make, Dream, Reimagining the Culture of Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math.
We found that those who are brilliant in science and math actually had a really strong artistic and a creative side. So, you know, in good wisdom, I guess, or in good research, they decided to include the A in STEM. And so that's how we got from going from STEM to STEAM. Now, unfortunately, the movement from STEM to STEAM has not been successful. And unfortunately, we still have the overall dire straits when it comes to getting particular populations to be engaged in STEM disciplines. So we're now at this sort of inflection point, like this moment. We said just STEM because they weren't doing well in it. We said STEAM because we thought the arts would fix it, but it's still not working. So where are we now? And that's where I come in. How do we reimagine this idea of STEAM? How do we not say just art, but art and culture, art and ancestry, art and imagination and aesthetics? And how do we reimagine what STEM and STEAM instruction looks like in classrooms? We changed the acronyms, but we never changed the pedagogy and the teaching. And so my work, my mission, even my book, STEM, STEAM, Make, Dream, is about how do we reimagine how we introduce young folks to these disciplines? How do we reimagine the arts? And how do we change the landscape of STEM education in this nation?
You know, I think people certainly recognize the reality that not every school system in the United States is created equal, and there are, you know, lots of systemic reasons for that. Does adoption of STEM sort of track along with that? Do the wealthy school systems in affluent areas, are they able to, do they have the extra bandwidth, the resources to be able to focus on this, where some of the communities that are struggling don't?
Dave, I'm going to say something really provocative here. And it is that even the most affluent school districts, who we would imagine are preparing young folks to be amazing in STEM, are also struggling with getting young folks to retain in STEM, to declare science majors or engineering majors. So we do have an issue with socioeconomics, right? Young folks in urban settings are not finding opportunities or resources are inhibiting them from being able to fully engage. And there are things that we have to do around equity with the distribution of resources, yes. But I also want to make clear that even the affluent school districts who have resources, who have the wealth to be able to introduce young folks to STEM, are also struggling with getting young folks to retain success in there. So the issue here is a national issue. And I think the solution is actually the same across the board, which is that STEM instruction must focus on the particular needs of a population, the particular artistic and cultural needs of young people, and must be relayed to what's going on in their lives every day. Now, if that approach is employed everywhere, I think we get better. But here's where it gets even more interesting, is the recognition that you can't standardize that. You can standardize the approach of censoring culture and censoring youth experiences and censoring, you know, what young people are into and meeting the needs of particular populations. But you will also have to recognize that there are different needs in different places, right? That more affluent school districts may do something completely different. And those students might have a very different culture than young folks in urban spaces. And so I think a solution to our problem is to recognize that instruction in STEM cannot be hyper-standardized. It must be localized. It must be unique to the needs of a population. And it must bend itself to where young folks are while keeping academic and intellectual expectations high. So we don't sacrifice the rigor, but we recognize that the approach to getting to the rigor must be different based on the different populations. There's no innate genius required to have a position in science and math. There's no, like, you're not born as a particular type of genius, and that's the reason why you're an engineer. No, it's just that you spend time with it. It's that you love it. It's that when you deal with it, when a problem arises, you sit with that problem long enough to be able to come up with solutions. You're creative and imaginative enough, and you have that stick-to-itiveness to be able to overcome those challenges. And that stick-to-itiveness, that creativity, that willingness to sit with a problem until you can solve it, that willingness to sit for 9, 10, 11, 12 hours with a problem until you solve it, comes with seeing yourself as part of that discipline. And so if we deal with the sort of socio-psychological dimensions of this work and convince young folks that science and math are what they can do, I'm not saying they're all going to be scientists and mathematicians, they certainly will feel like it's a part of who they are, and they're willing to put in the work to be successful academically. Now, whether or not it's their thing, what happened over the course of the journey, right? A kid can love science, think they're a scientist, and then stumble into pottery and say, you know what? I just want to do pottery for the rest of my life. But I'm a scientifically and mathematically literate person who ends up being someone who's interested in pottery. And someone might be like, oh my gosh, I'm into science and math. It's amazing. And guess what? I want to engage in nanotechnology. That's my decision. But I can engage in nanotechnology being a scientifically and mathematically literate person. So my work is about having an equal baseline of perception of self, of basic literacy in these subjects, of basic competency in these projects. And then as life unfolds, if it becomes your thing, you can leap into it and be successful. And if it does not be your, and even if it's not your profession, it can still be your thing. You can attach that to what your passion is. You know, I want a world where a kid is like, you know what? I'm a writer, but I'm a scientist. I want to be a science journalist. You know, I'm a scientist, but I'm really into swimming. I'm going to find ways to fine-tune my body and understand what I eat and train myself with scientific knowledge to be a better swimmer. It's about this baseline of equal scientific literacy and perception that it is a piece of your identity that we have to get to in this nation if we want to close the gaps between the science jobs and the science people.
That's Dr. Christopher Emden. The book is titled STEM, STEAM, Make, Dream: Reimagining the Culture of Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. There's a lot more to this conversation. If you want to hear more, head on over to CyberWire Pro and sign up for Interview Selects, where you get access to this and many more extended interviews.
Managing the requirements for modern security programs is increasingly challenging and time-consuming. Enter Vanta. Vanta gives you one place to centralize and scale your security program. Quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for ISO 27001, SOC 2, and more. You can leverage Vanta's market-leading trust management platform to unify risk management and secure the trust of your customers. Plus, use Vanta AI to save time when completing security questionnaires. CyberWire daily listeners can get $1,000 off by going to vanta.com/cyber. That's vanta.com/cyber.
The threat actor Muddy Water, also known as Mercury or Static Kitten, was recently attributed to Iran's Ministry of Intelligence and Security by U.S. Cyber Command. Tomer Barr is Director of Security Research at SafeBreach, and I checked in with him for some insights on Muddy Water.
So according to CISA, Muddy Water is a subunit under the Iranian Ministry of Intelligence and Security, And this APT group has conducted broad cyber campaigns in support of this ministry objectives since approximately 2017. And they are focused on cyber espionage, but they also use to deploy ransomware as part of their activity.
And so what is the current state of Muddy Waters activities? What are we seeing them doing these days?
Okay, so they are still active, very active. They never rest. And the targets are spread all over the globe. Mostly they are focused on the Middle East, but also we see targets from Asia to Africa, Europe, and North America as well. And they are targeting different sectors, the oil and natural gas sector, telecommunication, defense, local government, and other sectors. But this is the major sectors that they are targeting. And they are stealing victims' data. Also, there are some evidence that they share this stolen data with other malicious cyber threat actors. So it's very interesting.
And what sort of tools are they using to go about the things that they do? What are their techniques?
Okay, so they are using a lot of techniques, more than 20 different MITRE techniques all along the cyber kill chain. So for initial access, they usually use spear phishing. Sometimes they use spear phishing mails, including a zip file with an Excel that is includes a malicious macro. And once you are enabled the macro, it will run and infect the computer. And the second major attack vector is spear phishing using a PDF file that seems legitimate, but it drop a malicious file to the victim's network. So this is the initial access. And after the initial access, they use a lot of proprietary tools. They have a large arsenal, and they're very sophisticated developers because they are developing malwares in almost all the possible programming languages. I can at least say that they are using 6 programming languages, different ones, C++, PowerShell, VBA, WSF script, Python, JScript, and much more. Each tool is different and unique. And once the security researchers community thinks that we are capturing the tool, the next day comes and pop up their next tool. Sometimes they infect the same machine with more than one tool. If you want, I can detail some important facts on their main tools.
So when you're dealing with a threat actor like Muddy Water, who has such a spectrum of tools at their disposal that they're using, what are your recommendations for organizations to protect themselves?
It's a very good question. But before that, I will also mention that Muddy Water not only using their own self-developed tool, they are using a lot of public malwares and hack tools like Mimikatz, Lasagna, and other credential dumpers. And also they are commonly used post-exploitation framework, public one, like Empire, PowerSplate, Kodiak, and Rats. And they are also using GitHub and Pastebin for C2 server. So when customer, organization, enterprises design their security architecture, they should take to their attention that they need to are required to deal with self-developed tools and also public tools and communication to legit sites like Telegram, like GitHub or like Pastebin. So it's more difficult than other commodity tools. So, but there are a few recommendations that the CISA and we think that will keep you safe. So the first recommendation is to deploy application control software and limit which executable code can run by users. And extra attention should be paid to the email attachment and file download by via links in emails, which usually contains executable code. So these are more suspicious and should be taken care of with caution. Another recommendation is using a multi-factor authentication, because as I said, Muddy Water harvesting your credential. So if you will use multi-factor authentication, usually with a temp code or another mean of security like a cellular phone, then you will be most protected. So multi-factor authentication on webmail, VPNs, and any account which is the access is critical for the organization. Also, limit the use of administrator privileges. This is always good, not just for Muddy Water. It will limit the damage that the threat actor can do when they succeed in achieving the initial access. Of course, enable antivirus and anti-malware software. Of course, updating the signature definition in a timely manner, because an antivirus which is not updated, it's like if you have no antivirus at all. Sometimes you can consider adding an email banner to emails received from outside of the organization and disabling hyperlinks in those mails, because this is not the majority of the emails and they are more suspicious. And last but not least, train your user. It's not just about technology and security controls. Sometimes the weakest point of cybersecurity are the user, which need just one mistake, and you are welcoming the Iranian APT into your environment. So do training awareness, simulations, and recognizing the importance of phishing report and social engineering attempts between the employees, and adapt threat reputation service, and finally install updates and patches to the operating system software and firmware, because Muddy Water is using plenty of exploit against Exchange and against Microsoft Office, and also against the domain controller in order to achieve domain admin privileges and getting the entire network under their control.
That's Tomer Barr from Safe Breach. That's the CyberWire. For links to all of today's stories, check out our daily briefing at thecyberwire.com. Don't miss this weekend's Research Saturday and my conversation with John Hammond from Huntress. We're discussing targeted APT activity. Baby Shark is out for blood. That's Research Saturday. Check it out. The CyberWire podcast is proudly produced in Maryland out of the startup studios of Data Tribe, where they're co-building the next generation of cybersecurity teams and technologies. Our amazing CyberWire team is Liz Irvin, Elliot Peltzman, Trey Hester, Brandon Karpf, Eliana White, Peru Prakash, Justin Sabi, Tim Nodar, Joe Kerrigan, Carol Terrio, Ben Yellen, Nick Vilecki, Gina Johnson, Bennett Moe, Chris Russell, John Petrick, Jennifer Ivan, Rick Howard, Peter Kilpie, and I'm Dave Bittner. Thanks for listening. We'll see you back here next week.
Now a word from our sponsor, Netskope. Netskope is a worldwide leader in SASE and Zero Trust. Its unified platform, Netskope One, provides optimized access and Zero Trust security for people, devices, and data anywhere they go, helping customers reduce risk, accelerate performance, and get unrivaled visibility into any cloud, web, and private application activity. To learn more about how Netskope helps customers be ready for anything on their SASE journey, visit netskope.com.